Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we're going to talk to Ali Gharib, a frequent guest when it comes to talking about Syria. Then we're going to speak with Frank Joyce. Frank is a journalist and an activist in Detroit. He's a Detroit native, and he has some things to say about the mainstream discourse over Detroit's recent bankruptcy. Finally, we're going to speak to Mark Kleiman from UCLA. He's one of the leading experts on marijuana policy, and he's also Washington State's drug czar. Now, usually I do a little introduction where I speak about some of the news stories that got me riled up this week, but we have a lot of show, so instead we're just going to jump right into it. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Ali Gharib. Always happy to have my next guest on the show. He was on just a few weeks back to discuss Syria, and that story has come a long way since, so I figured I'd have him back on. Ali Gharib is a writer with The Daily Beast. Ali, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
It is a pleasure to be back, Josh. What's going on?
Now, last time we spoke, it looked like a unilateral U.S. attack on Syria was imminent. I figured missiles were going to be flying any time. I was actually, last week's show, I was afraid that I had a debate with John Judas about it, and I was afraid that the debate would kind of be moot because I thought that we would be attacking by the time it broadcast. I'm sure I'm not the only person to be caught off guard by President Obama's speech where he said, yep, we're going to attack, but I'm going to ask Congress first. What's your sense of how the administration is doing getting a resolution out of Congress?
Yeah, he's not doing very well. There's still, you know, it still could really go either way because there's a whole mass of undecided sort of sitting on the fence with this. But yeah, generally the no's and likely no's are looking stronger than the yes's. There's enough undecideds to swing that. But
yes,
if things continue to break along the lines that they already have, this resolution will not pass. Your frequent debating partner, Michael Cohen, on Twitter was making odds that they got about a 25% chance of passing it. And that doesn't sound unreasonable to me.
Think Progress did a kind of whip count. They found that there was 217 no or no leaning votes in the House. And there's also this kind of liberal libertarian coalition forming there. Somebody did, I think it was Jonathan Bernstein for the Washington Post, did an analysis, and he found that there was dozens and dozens of overlapping votes with the recent effort to limit NSA spying, which fell narrowly. My own sense is that, you know, intervening in Syria is fraught with peril. And while I don't think Obama went to Congress hoping that they'd say no to give him an out, I do think that he figured that if Congress said no, it would be a way to back off of his red line and not take on the responsibility of a mission that could go very, very wrong.
Yeah, at least the full responsibility. I think that's true. But that said, I don't think that it was, you know, as you said, I don't think he did it thinking, you know, hoping that the vote would fail. But I think he did it precisely because the unilateral attack that was being discussed for a week leading up to his announcement really had no legitimacy whatsoever. And that's not even to get into questions of whether a strike would be legal or not in terms of international law. But there was zero legitimacy to it because he had no international backing. The only partners at the time that he announced the vote to Congress who publicly backed the U.S. strike were Turkey and France, the Arab League, our allies in the region who hate Assad and are feeding the opposition weapons and money. Even they wouldn't publicly back it. Everybody was running away from it. And then there was that the amazing vote in the U.K.'s parliament where they voted down David Cameron's push to authorize Britain to join the U.S. in a strike. And then, you know, there wasn't even a public opinion mandate for Obama. So I think really in the face of having absolutely zero legitimacy, he thought, man, I need to do something in order to be able to say that there is something other than just me deciding to pull this strike off. And I think that he probably recognized that that was a gamble, though I don't think, as you said and as I agreed, that he went in with the idea that it would fail.
Right. I think that that's clear. And he's certainly lobbying hard for it. I think that this pause that he's gotten while Congress debates is also giving Obama an opportunity to try, at least to try, to build some international legitimacy for a strike. As we record this, Obama's in Russia for the G20 meeting. It was interesting to see
He's just back this morning.
Okay. Well, the EU put out a statement. They were kind of closer to Vladimir Putin's position than to Obama's. I was kind of surprised by that. You know, this gets to an issue that I think is just kind of baffling. I have a piece up at BillMoyers.com titled "The Irreconcilable Paradox of Calls to Strike Syria." And I point out that the justification for these strikes is to uphold an international norm, right? The prohibition against using chemical weapons. But there's another norm that I think is so much, much more important, and that's the norm toward multilateral security, that you can't just go and attack another country with the exception of self-defense or when working in concert with the international community. And I note in that piece that it's a violation of the UN Charter to even threaten to use force against another country, except in those circumstances. So when Obama gave that speech in the Rose Garden about the importance of international law, he was flouting international law. Can you make any sense of this?
No, I can't. I thought your piece was great about this. You had this. You had this great comparison where you said that the norm against chemical weapons, which has been came out of World War I and the 150,000 deaths there by gassing, was it's not that it's unimportant and that it doesn't establish an order that has benefited the world. But the norm that came out of World War II, which was the legitimacy of the international system and the UN as the only legitimate venue for the use of force by states, is a much more important international norm. And in fact, it's one that it's had a much greater impact on stability throughout the world. And I think that's right on. You can't. It's really difficult to make any sense of it now. You know, there have been violations, obviously, of both those norms. There have been states that have used power, that have used military force outside of the UN. The U.S. has done it several times, many times.
Of course.
And there have now been a handful of states that have used chemical weapons. And, let's just assume for the moment that, the basic contours of intelligence reports that have come out so far, that Assad's government was responsible for the chemical attack, even if he didn't order it himself. You know, these are repeated patterns, and I think that your argument is sort of right that not responding to the international norm against chemical weapons is actually less important to world stability and kind of a broader, longer picture than being unresponsive to the international norm of the legitimate use of force through the UN Security Council.
And you know, the thing that I keep hearing, I'm just switching tacks here a little bit, is about public opinion. As you noted, this is the least popular proposed conflict for the last 20 years of Gallup polling or something like that. There's really great opposition. The most recent poll out had 51% against, 36% for. And that's even, you know, that those polls also presume that Assad was in fact guilty, which I believe is most likely the case.
And that's even polling on limited strikes. You know,
we're not
talking about a broad intervention here. We're talking about the sort of limited thing that Obama has proposed.
Exactly. But one thing that kind of gets under my craw is that the pundits keep saying, well, Americans are war weary. And, you know, I think, well, maybe we've been through a couple of very complicated Middle Eastern conflicts with sectarian aspects and very vicious, very hard to sort out. Maybe we've actually seen that the United States is extremely bad at nation building, at governing once we've achieved our narrow military objectives. I mean, maybe we've just learned some valuable lessons from recent history rather than being just kind of exhausted.
Yeah, I think it would be nice to change the terminology on that, that it's, you know, America has become war learned instead of war weary. Because it's like, you know, the idea of being war weary is like, you know, maybe we'll take a little disco nap and then when we wake up we'll be ready to wage massive wars in the Middle East again.
Right.
Like, I think that that era might be behind us, and it's not because we're like tired of it, it's because we learned some freaking lessons.
Yes, I agree with that. Now, Ali, you're not in favor of blasting Syria with cruise missiles, neither am I. I do think there's kind of an assumption in the United States that we have to react to world events, that we have to do something. Of course, if that something is likely to make matters worse and end in, you know, more suffering, then I think there's a moral imperative to not do anything. But having said that, is there anything that you would advocate the United States do in regard to Syria?
Yeah, there's, you know, that's the thing about, like, doing something. The problem is that, like, we've been ingrained into this mentality. We're doing something to respond to international crises almost always means is a euphemism for military force.
Exactly.
And there are things that we can do. You know, and honestly, I have to say that I'm not just diamond. I'm not a pacifist.
Right.
Like I've dabbled in pacifism, as Walter Sobchak says. But I'm not a pacifist, and I can see legitimate examples for the use of state force. I would want them to always go through the UN Security Council. Sometimes that's not entirely possible. And, like, I can envision situations where I may hypothetically say, okay, this isn't possible, and the U.S. has a core interest here, and military force is a last resort to solve it and should be employed. But I'm against doing these strikes the way, certainly, that they've been organized now. And I don't think that we have core interests at stake in core national interests at stake in Syria. And there are other options, stuff that the U.S. can be doing. You know, there was this really extraordinary statement from John Kerry during the Senate Foreign Relations hearing that he did, where he's trying to sell this war to Congress, where he said that the Arab states have offered to pay for U.S. strikes all the way up to a U.S. invasion. They've offered to pay for it. Now, that is a remarkable, remarkable admission, because these guys won't even publicly back the war.
Right.
The Saudis and the Emirates won't put out a statement even saying that they back U.S. strikes.
Right.
But they're willing to pay for it. Now, you know, it would be really nice if those cash-rich Saudi states would put some of that money into the UN refugee effort, which, you know, the largest refugee crisis in the world is what we're talking about in Syria right now. And the UN effort to house, feed, and take care of these refugees is only 40% funded. So why don't these guys put their money where their mouth is and help some Syrians? But the truth is that our Gulf allies are not really interested in helping Syrians. They don't care about ordinary people. They don't care about democracy. They're playing a geopolitical chess game with Iran. And you know, so I think that the U.S. should encourage them and our allies to push for funding this refugee problem. And there's other things you can do. You know, one of the most disappointing things I've seen so far was that Samantha Power, the former human rights ideologue from Harvard, who's now in the administration as the UN ambassador, gave the speech to the Center for American Progress. So here you have this progressive human rights activist speaking to a purportedly progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., and she had this amazing quote where she said, you know, even if Russia and China were to agree, okay, can I just back up for 1 second? Sorry.
Sure.
To ramble here. There's been talk of trying to refer Assad to the International Criminal Court. Now, because Syria is not party to the treaty that established that court, that means that it would require a referral from the UN Security Council, which is, next to impossible because of Russia's intransigence at the council to even do, you know, mildly condemn Bashar Assad. But she said, Sam Powers said it at the Center for American Progress, even if Russia and China were to agree, then what could the ICC possibly accomplish? What could the International Criminal Court possibly accomplish? I mean, it's just really an astounding anti-internationalist perspective and sort of against the international system of human rights that Sam Power has put her life's work. You know, I don't agree with her, but I've admired up to her joining the administration her intellectual honesty. It might even be called intellectual bluntness.
Right.
That she's always been so consistent on these matters.
Absolutely.
And for her to get up and say something like that is really incredible. And, you know, an international lawyer friend of mine had sent me a press release just a couple days before where it was about how in January the U.S. had refused to sign a letter by 58 states that would refer Assad to the international – that would press the case for referring Assad to the International Criminal Court. The U.S. refused to even sign this letter. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And then Sam Power gets up and makes these statements. Well, Human Rights Watch noted that her attack that what could the ICC do is actually wrong, that in conflicts in the Balkans and in other places, bringing criminal indictments against military and political leaders has had the effect of freezing people out of the equation to make diplomatic peace deals more viable, and it's also had an effect of deterrence. I mean, that is such an astounding way to think about this, that, like, the Obama administration is contemplating limited airstrikes as a means of deterring Assad and others from doing future chemical attacks. Well, this ICC route has done the same thing, and it does it through the levers of international human rights law and international justice, and the Obama administration won't even go so far as to sign a letter and is crapping all over the idea in public speeches by administration officials. I mean, it is just really astounding to watch.
And no civilian casualties are involved with acts of international law. Ali,
yeah.
Thank you so much. I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you for taking the time today.
Not at all. It's a pleasure, Joshua.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Frank Joyce to talk about Detroit.
I'm a doorbell. Oh, well.
back to Politics and Reality Radio. My next guest is Frank Joyce. Frank is an activist and a writer and a regular on Live from the Land of Hopes and Dreams, which is a show on Sirius XM. Frank, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Frank's got a piece up at alternet.org, my former home, titled The Real Story Behind the Decline of Detroit. And yes, great things are happening there too. And I wanted to have Frank on because I'm really tired of the kind of dominant storyline about how Detroit's greedy public workers brought the city to ruin. I think it's simplistic and it's an ideological narrative. Frank, let me start off by asking you to give us a sense of what happened to Detroit. I mean, we all know the story of a lot of auto manufacturing moving overseas. It was a mono industrial town, more or less. And that not only meant the loss of a lot of good blue-collar jobs, but also a significant weakening of the UAW, so the remaining jobs weren't as good. But you write that there's a lot more to it.
Well, for sure there's a lot more to it. And one of the points that I make, and while there's, of course, truth to all of the macroeconomic narratives that have swept over Detroit, but those macroeconomic narratives have swept over other places as well and not produced yet, at any rate, the same outcome. In particular, what I spend a fair amount of time in my piece talking about is the racism of Detroit, as evidenced in particular by incredible residential segregation that goes back many, many decades and came about as a result of very deliberate policies, both by the government and by the financial and insurance and housing industries. And they took advantage of the rising income during the period when Detroit's economy was expanding to create a vast urban sprawl network, which is the suburbs are, of course, primarily white, somewhat less so now than at their peak, but still predominantly white. And that distorts both the economics of the region and the politics of the region in ways that I think, as I say, people don't pay enough attention to.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit and get specific, because as you say, you do make it clear in the piece that it's not just kind of whites drifting out of the city. There's kind of a history of white supremacy from policymakers that really aggravated the racial segregation that we see today. So tell us a little bit more about federal housing policy and how that affected it.
Well, for a long time in the post-World War II economic boom and housing boom, which saw a lot of housing construction both in Detroit and the suburbs, it was the policy of both the Federal Housing Administration and of banks and lenders and so on, first within the city to maintain very rigidly segregated neighborhoods. And then, as that began to break down for various reasons and as whites began to leave, and this starts in the 1950s, this is not a recent phenomenon.
Right.
Freeways are built, housing is built. Ironically, the infrastructure of the water and sewage of all of Southeast Michigan was constructed by the city of Detroit. One of the things that's in play in the bankruptcy is the water and sewage system, which is still technically owned by the city of Detroit. And so you have this massive out-migration of whites that African Americans were not permitted to participate in. My involvement as an activism began in the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and as recently as 1960, I picketed a swimming pool at the infamous 8 Mile boundary of Detroit in one of its western cross streets, 8 Mile and Greenfield. It was called the Crystal Pool, that would not permit African American kids to swim there. And I participated in sit-ins and other activities in restaurants and bars and churches, I might add, in the Detroit suburbs, also in the 60s, that were still segregated. And when we went there with interracial teams and people, invariably the first thing that happened is that the police were called. Now, at that point, this was in the middle of the civil rights movement, and the police would come and they would tell the owner or whoever it was, well, we're sorry, this is not illegal, we can't do anything about it. it. But it speaks to the extent of segregation and the extent of hostility to African Americans from whites. Fast forward to the present day, and I urge people in my piece to do this, to read the comments section of the Detroit News or the Free Press or the Wall Street Journal or anybody talking about Detroit is to see a really appalling and sickening expression of hatred and really the attitude towards Detroit on the part of a lot of whites, both suburbanites, outstaters in Michigan, and people around the country, is this kind of, this glee, this, well, they deserve this punishment. Somehow
right.
They brought this on all by themselves. And, of course, that's not what happened at all. These were very deliberate policies that also refused home improvement loans to African Americans who were trapped in the city. So that in some cases, if they wanted to improve their property, unless they had some other source of income or access to loans, they couldn't do it. It's a very vicious cycle.
And the racism in the rhetoric over the city's failure is really marked. And it's like, you know, blacks can't govern themselves. Folks, Frank in the piece also mentions that if you buy a home that hasn't changed hands in the suburbs, if it hasn't changed hands in a while, it may still have a covenant in the deed that bars the sale to quote unquote Negroes. So, you know,
yep.
This is
it's still true.
And as
you know, it's sort of a cultural artifact. It's not that common nowadays.
And they're not enforceable. I should point out they're no longer enforceable. Those covenants.
Correct.
Yes. Right.
Yes.
But
exactly,
they're
right.
A reflection of the history. I think a telling reflection of the history. You also talk about how as the as the suburbs grew whiter and more affluent, there were attempts to link the three main counties via a kind of tri-county transit authority to give people rapid transit, give people from the city a chance to get out to those newly affluent suburbs and work those jobs. What happened to those attempts?
23 out of 23 pieces of legislation introduced at the state level, which of course is where it has to go if you're talking about creating some kind of regional authority, were defeated by suburban and outstate white legislators. And Detroit has one of the worst public transportation systems, both within the city and between the city and the suburbs of any city anywhere. Now, some of that is admittedly attributable to the auto industry, which wasn't never interested in public transportation.
Right, of course.
And the power, of course, of the big three here in Detroit was itself a factor in seeing to it that, for example, freeways were built instead of a subway system or a rail system or even any kind of sophisticated bus system. But this also goes to this combination of intentional and unintentional racism that has contributed to the economic and political and social isolation of the city of Detroit. And here again, this has deep roots and has been going on for a long time, but as recently as, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 years ago, Livonia, Michigan, which is a very large 200,000-plus population suburb to the west of Detroit, is still, I believe, the most segregated city of its size in the entire United States. Had an enormous brouhaha because Walmart wanted to build a store there, and citizens of Livonia stood up in public hearings and said quite shamelessly and quite openly, we don't want a Walmart store here because it will attract both African-American employees and African-American customers, and we don't want that.
Wow.
So these attitudes are not just historical. They're very much alive and well in the Detroit area today. Now, I have to say also that there are good white people and there are good African-American people, and there are efforts in many communities to promote dialogue and to look at policy solutions to these kinds of problems and so on. But it's a very difficult struggle, and it's a microcosm of a struggle I think we face as a nation. Lots of things that are true in the United States are happening in the Detroit area kind of like it's like watching a preview of a movie or something. It's quicker here and it's more intense, but it isn't, and it may be different in degree, but it's not different in kind from the rest of the country.
Now, Frank, there's this other kind of thing that I see a sense in, throughout the piece where, you know, the state seems to be extracting cash from the city. Tell me about the Detroit income taxes and the two-tiered income tax system where the city is losing hundreds of millions of dollars per year.
Yes, but quite a few years ago, the state legislature authorized the city of Detroit to begin collecting an income tax. And the income tax is at one rate for those who both work and live in the city, and at a lower rate for those who only work in the city and who commute to Detroit, usually from suburbs. And when they set up this system, this is such a classic example of how institutional racism works, the law requires that city-based employers collect the tax in through payroll deduction, as we're all used to for federal and state and other taxes. But they carved out an exception for a business not based in Detroit, but that had an office or a factory or a shop or something in the city, that they did not have to collect the income tax for those workers. And only 15% of employers do that, and only a tiny percentage of workers then take the initiative to pay the tax on their own, which they're legally required to do.
Right.
And estimates are that this has cost $142 million a year or more over a period, I don't even know, over a very long period of time, more decades, or at least a decade. So this is an example of how wealth is transferred from the city of Detroit to either the suburbs or the state itself. And too little attention, it seems to me, is paid in the conversation about Detroit and its crisis and its so-called bankruptcy to what has happened to impair the revenue stream of the city. And as you said when we started, lots of attention gets paid to so-called overpaid, you know, city bus drivers or trash collectors or whatever, who, God forbid, might work for 30 or 40 years and have a $19,000 a year pension.
Right.
But there's a revenue stream interruption and interference process that goes on here as well. And it's all of a piece, because when you get state control of the city schools, for example, as has been true virtually continuously for 14 years now, and the state has so mismanaged the Detroit public school system that all of the trends of declining enrollment, of lower test scores, of higher deficits contribute to the decline in the property values of the homes that are still here, which also reduces revenue collection by the city itself. So people sometimes with good intention, sometimes with bad ones, talk about Detroit as a laboratory. Well, it is a laboratory, and among other things, it's a laboratory of institutional racism and what the costs of that can turn out to be, in my opinion.
If you're just tuning in, this is Joshua Holland. This is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm speaking with Frank Joyce about Detroit. Frank, you mentioned the schools being under control of Lansing. I want to get into this issue a little bit more. You write in the piece, and I quote, "Detroit's bankruptcy is the effect of democracy's power already lost, not the cause of it. It is but one more small step in a decades-long process." Tell us about the emergency managers, this whole issue of the city really not being under its own control.
Well, the schools are, in my opinion, the most dramatic example, but they are hardly the only one. What has happened over the last at least 20 years is that if there was an asset that suburban or outstate whites thought was of value to them, they mostly, with one example that I'll get to in a minute, have figured out a way to take control of it. An example of that would be Cobo Hall. Cobo Hall, every big city has a big convention center, and Cobo Hall is the name of the Convention Center in Detroit. It happens to be the headquarters of the North American International Auto Show, which is held here in January every year, and which is a very big deal to the auto industry, and right. It is a global event. And in order to get more control over labor conditions and finances and so on and so forth, there has been created a regional authority that now has control of Cobo Hall. And there's this incredible, I use the term in the piece, a dizzying array of regional authorities, of private-public partnerships. But if you look at it, if you step back and take the long view, there has been a kind of chipping away process at the ability of the city to control its own resources, its own tax policy, its own revenue stream that has been going on for many, many years. One way to see that in dramatic relief is to look at one exception to that rule. And as you and listeners have probably heard, there's now talk that the art collection of the Detroit Institute of Arts may go up for sale or up for collateral on a loan within the bankruptcy process, because for some reason or other, the people who managed to take over Cobo Hall, who managed to not create a regional transportation system, who managed to do all of these other things, somehow neglected to protect the artwork that is an asset of the city of Detroit. It is owned by the city of Detroit, and that is not in dispute. So they are frantically now trying to pass laws in the state legislature and do other things to protect that asset because it matters to them.
Right.
Other things that don't matter to them, such as whether City of Detroit employees have modest pensions or not, they don't care about.
Right.
But art, they do care about. But it illustrates this whole dynamic of these regional authorities and public-private partnerships and foundations taking over the management of institutions and so on and so forth. And it's this, again, this incremental process that I think people don't look at, and they just see this dramatic, the B word, bankruptcy, as though all of this happened overnight. Not at all. It's a very cumulative process.
Frank, we think of the city of Detroit as destitute. You note in the piece that there's money pouring in. There's tons of money pouring in. Let me ask you this. Is this money kind of scavengers coming to pick the last meat off the bone, or is it the kind of investment that, you know, could create a base for a new Detroit?
It's both. Let's talk about the scavengers first. One of the most dramatic examples of this, and you know, I'm a Detroit lifer. I've lived either in the city or the suburbs for longer than I'd care to say, but this even blows my mind. In the middle of this bankruptcy, in the middle of Detroit as the poster child for brokenness, the legislature has enacted and authorized a bond issue that is going to hand $650 million over to the billionaire owner of the Detroit Red Wings to construct a new hockey stadium.
Unbelievable.
In Detroit. It is unbelievable. And this is a liability that Detroit residents will have to carry for who knows how long. So that's an example of the continued, I don't know if, robbery, I don't know a better word for it, of
right.
the taxpayers of Detroit in order to transfer assets and wealth to already extremely rich people. Now, the theory behind this, of course, is that we've had this notion for years here that with casinos and stadiums and so on and so forth, and other cities do this too, even if white people won't come to live in Detroit, they'll come to visit and that will create some sort of economy. Well, it doesn't. I mean, there are studies on stadiums and casinos galore that prove that these are not the job and revenue generators that that they say they are.
That's right.
But there's another side to the story, and that is there are all kinds of investments from young people, artists and musicians and so on, responding to Detroit's cultural history, who are moving into Detroit and who are becoming an economic force. There's an institution now started in 1997 called the Avalon Bakery that was started by Jackie Victor and Ann Peralt. as a socially responsible business that's undergoing tremendous growth. They just acquired a large new property to expand their business. And there are all kinds of shape-shifting urban agriculture, alternative schools, alternative transportations. Detroit really is a kind of laboratory for a lot of innovative thinking about co-ops and new economic systems and so on. So there's very much a positive side to this. And the line I use in the story is that the government is bankrupt, but Detroit is not.
Frank, I want to thank you so much for joining us this week. I think we're about out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
Folks, that was Frank Joyce. Check out his piece on alternet.org. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Mark Kleiman.
Everybody's got a thing, but some don't know how to handle it. Always reaching out in vain, just taking the things not worth having. But don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama, 'cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it out. You say your style of life's a drag and that you must go other places, but just don't you feel too bad when you get fooled by smiling faces. Don't you worry about a thing. Don't you worry about a thing, mama, 'cause I'll be standing on the side when you check it.
Back to the Politics and Reality Radio. My next guest is one of the country's top experts on marijuana policy. He's a professor of public policy at UCLA. He is a co-editor of the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis, and he writes on the Same Facts blog, which you can read at samefacts.com. Mark is also Washington State's first pot czar, heading the effort to regulate one of the country's first legal marijuana markets. Mark Kleiman, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
First of all, I wanted to ask you about a memo put out by the Department of Justice this week that got a lot of attention. What did it say, and do you think it marked the beginning of the end of the war on drugs, as some commenters have suggested?
I think that's way over-interpreting. An interesting but not dramatic development. What it said was that the Justice Department respects the operation of robust state, what it calls robust state control systems, and that in states that have such systems, in general, it will not be a good use of federal resources to prosecute somebody who's operating within the state rules unless it impacts one of eight identified priorities: access by minors, out-of-state sales, connection with cartels, violence, and so on. So this doesn't give anybody a get-out-of-jail-free card,
right.
But it does say that those systems will essentially be allowed to operate. And yeah, that's news.
Now, So I'm a liberal guy, and I think pot prohibition is really problematic because we end up sending lots of people through the criminal justice system for something that isn't, I think, as dangerous as alcohol. They end up with records that dog them for the rest of their lives. And I think the black market marijuana, illegal marijuana, helps fuel the drug war. And, you know, just as alcohol prohibition led to lots of violence between gangsters. I also like federal preemption when it comes to things like extremely harsh anti-immigration laws in places like Arizona and Georgia, right?
Right.
Now, it just so happens that you published a paper recently that helps me reconcile these two views. You offered a couple of strategies to reconcile federal law with state law. Can you tell us a little bit about your proposals?
Right. And it's worth noticing that the Attorney General didn't take any either of those suggestions, suggesting how much influence I actually have. One of those options is something that could have been done and could still be done. And there was a little bit of a hint from one state officials that there might be such a thing under consideration. The federal drug law, the Controlled Substances Act, commands the Attorney General, who's the chief law enforcement officer, to cooperate with state and local authorities in enforcing the law, and allows the Attorney General to enter into contractual agreements with those localities. And so the question is, could such a contract, in effect a treaty between the federal government and the state, specify that the federal government would not interfere with state licensed operations, unless, except under specified circumstances, in return for which the state would agree to do some amount of enforcement designed to keep the material in state and out of the hands of minors, for example. So that's a more formal way of getting more or less to where this memo gets,
right,
which is we will allow the operation of the state licensed systems, but we will enforce where we think that the activity interferes with important federal priorities.
And in the paper you make,
so that was the easy way. That was the administrative way. There was the alternative proposal, which was where I really started, was a legislative proposal, which would have formally allowed individual states to apply for waivers, for exemptions from the cannabis provisions of the federal drug law. To make, because notice, what the Attorney General did here and what would have been done under an agreement with the states would not have made anything legal.
Right.
That's currently illegal. Right. Everything that goes on in Colorado and Washington under those licenses will still be a federal violation of federal law. It's just that you're not likely to be arrested for it. Under the waivers idea, it would actually be legal activity.
And that's
an important distinction, I think.
And you make the point in the paper that, you know, even though this is a violation of federal law, I may get the numbers wrong because I skimmed it, but there are only like something like 4,000 DEA officers in the country and 500,000 cops.
Correct.
So, you know, if the federal government really wants help with these priorities that it's outlined, money going to drug gangs, gun violence, driving while intoxicated, people giving marijuana to children, then it could really tap that, you know, the states and local law enforcement, they certainly have something to offer.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, look, let's not overpromise. Prohibition fails to keep cannabis from children.
That's right.
There's no reason to think that legalization will do better.
Right. Right.
In fact, it'll probably do worse, right? So there's no illegal or almost no illegal alcohol production in the U.S. Moonshining is essentially out of fashion.
Right.
But a substantial fraction of the alcohol market is people under 21 who can't legally buy it, and they get it from people who are over 21 and can legally buy it. It's diverted from the licensed system into the juvenile market. 25% of the cannabis sold in the U.S. is sold to people under 21.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Mark. You know, if you have a drug dealer who's breaking the law, isn't that drug dealer going to be more likely to not care if kids are underage than a licensed marijuana seller who can lose that license?
Oh, I think it will probably be hard for juveniles to get cannabis from licensed cannabis sellers.
It's just the resale.
They will get it from their older brothers.
From their older brothers, right?
I mean, that's the reason that I created college seniors, to supply college freshmen.
I mean, in Brooklyn, when I was in high school, we would stand outside a grocery store and just get a cool-looking older guy to buy us beer.
Well, you're obviously a more refined world. I mean, the other version is you stand outside a liquor store in a poor neighborhood, and there's a wino standing outside the liquor store who's happy to go in and buy something for you in return for, you know, a portion of the purchase,
right,
for him to consume himself.
Right.
No way to stop that. And if you ask the question, given that juveniles are going to get access to cannabis, would you rather have them have access to regulated and tested cannabis known to be free of impurities and produced by a legal business? Or would you rather have them, you know, get cannabis from the Cali cartel and have no idea what's in it?
Folks, if you're just tuning in, this is Joshua Holland, and I'm speaking with Mark Kleinman from UCLA. Now, Mark, before I let you go, I really want to get a sense of a little insight into how implementation is going in Washington State. This is a brand new thing that's going on. Can you give us just a sense of some of the, I don't know, stumbling points the state has faced in implementing this new law and how you're working them out?
Yeah, just to make clear what my role is. Pot czar is a label that's gotten applied by the press. I'm not an official of Washington State. My company has a contract to provide some essentially technical information.
But you're advising regulators, right?
We're advising regulators.
Okay.
Or better, we're providing information to regulators.
Okay.
Some of the stumbling blocks they faced. The law in Washington provides for sales of usable cannabis, defined essentially as flowers, and of cannabis-infused products such as beverages and foods. It doesn't have a provision for the sale of concentrates.
Okay, so that's like hashish
or the extracted, you know, hash oils.
Right.
So did that mean that the licensed stores weren't going to have that? Because the medical outlets have it.
Yes.
It's a rising share of the market. There's reason to think that it probably has some health advantages over burning plant material.
Right.
Particularly if it's used by vaporization. On the other hand, it probably has some risks. Because it's a more concentrated form, you're more likely to get too much of it. But the other problem is a definitional one. Right? It's clear that if you took some hash oil and put a drop of it into a gallon of milk, you now have cannabis-infused milk, legal
right.
product.
Right.
What if you put a drop of milk into a gallon of cannabis, butane hash oil? At what point does a diluted concentrate become an infused product? And I think the answer is there's no obvious way to do that. So I think they're going to go back to the legislature and say, come on, guys, give us the definition. But there's a real issue if they make the definition too tight that you're going to prop up the, again, not one but two parallel markets. So there's the market that the liquor board is setting up. There's the medical market, which is substantially unregulated. It's a long story about that. But a substantially unregulated but quite vigorous medical market that might have, I don't know, half the business in Western Washington. And then you've got the strictly illegal business. So there are gangs from British Columbia that have moved their growing operations from B.C. into Washington, essentially because it's easier to move pot than people across the border. Easier to move people than pot across the border.
Right.
You've got outfits in central Washington, and apparently Mexican gang affiliations doing growing there. So, again, it's not the case that what the board forbids to be sold in licensed stores will be unavailable. What the board forbids to be sold in licensed stores will be sold instead illegally or through the medical outlets.
Right, right.
The whole question of whether a commercial industry, which is going to be very taxed, about 40% of what a customer pays for cannabis in Washington State will be taxed. Well, the medical outlets are entirely untaxed. The commercial outlets have to meet lots of regulatory requirements. They have to test their product and provide paperwork and have a tracking system and have security and so on and so on and so on. The medical outlets have none of those costs. So there's a question about whether the commercial market will in fact be competitive.
Right.
Either with purely illicit market or with the medical market. And that still has to be worked out.
Interesting. Let me ask you one final question. Marijuana, I think, is one of a couple of issues where we've seen a real sea change in public policy, along with LGBT rights. And what we saw with gay marriage is that it's kind of spread from state to state to state. We've seen that certainly with medical marijuana. Are we at the beginning do you expect to see a rapid shift in more and more states moving towards this legal tax and regulate scheme and away from, treating marijuana possession as a crime?
Well, there's a strong move against treating marijuana possession as a crime. That's sort of independent, right? Lots of states have decriminalized.
Right.
The question is whether you want to treat production and sale as crimes. I would be very surprised if Colorado or Washington were the last state to do that.
Right.
It certainly looks now like there's momentum behind not only other states following suit, but eventually federal level legalization. But as Yogi Berra is supposed to have said, predictions are dangerous, especially about the future. This is not the first time there's been heavy momentum in a liberalizing direction on pot.
Right.
And it reversed very sharply in 1979.
Right.
If we get bad results in Colorado or Washington, I can easily imagine public opinion shifting again. But at the moment, certainly the energy is on the side of the legalizers. The weak response from the drug warriors to what's going on in Colorado and Washington, it seems to me, is very strongly symptomatic.
And I think
a bill in Congress to tell the federal government to accommodate to what the states have done. There's no bill punishing the states for what they did, right? I mean, and a state that doesn't have a ban on drinking for people under 21 loses highway funds.
Right.
And Congress has done this before. No movement in that direction.
Interesting.
Not a single right-wing politician, media outlet, or fundraising activity which has decided to make this the issue that they're going to, scare their donors about.
Right.
But yes, there's a reasonable case that when you got a $35 billion illicit business, it's time to say, okay, we tried to control this stuff and we didn't. And I think that's the closest expression I can get to what seems to be the sort of median voter mood on this question. So that raises the question whether we're going to go down the same, it seems to me, misguided path we took with alcohol and allow the creation of a large and very unscrupulous industry.
So
people are making a lot of money off other people's drug addiction.
So big pot.
If somebody allow that same thing to happen with cannabis.
The concern about
I'd much
pot.
Rather have legalization without, well, big or small, I'd much rather have legalization without commercialization.
Right.
Either co-ops or state stores.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's not a possibility while we've got the existing federal law. Washington did not have the option of saying we're going to make this a state monopoly. Because, again, you can't have state officials violating the federal law.
Right.
And if you ask me to guess, my guess is by the time the country's ready to move, we'll have an established industry that can't be pushed aside. We're already seeing that on the medical side.
Right. Right.
And we'll wind up with a heavily promoted product. Designed to make as many acts as possible because that's the only way to make any money. You can't make any money selling pot. People don't smoke too much.
Right.
Plus they don't spend enough. That's what I can't persuade my libertarian friends of.
Yes, I'm not surprised. Mark Kleiman, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
Folks, it's behind a paywall, but if you want to read Mark's paper, you can do so at the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis. I'd also like to thank Ali Gharib and Frank Joyce. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can follow my stuff at BillMoyers.com. You can send an email griping about this show to joshuahall@gmail.com. And of course, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Have a great week.
Got can he do to you the things that I do? I can take you higher. I'm on fire.